why don't you put this bed rail down? And I said, Mom, because you can't walk, and it's for your safety. She goes, well, if you put the rail down, maybe I could walk. And it's like, no. And another time she said, why is it I always call you? Why don't you ever call me? And I said, Mom, you call me, I come running. I call you, what are you going to do?
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, I'm speaking with Mark Steven Porro. Now, Mr. Porro is an amazing guy. He started out his career in acting. We're going to talk quite a bit about just his roles that he's been a part of, kind of his time in Hollywood, why he decided to move on from it. And the reasoning is one that we spend a lot of time on, and that is that his mother, just like a lot of people, was aging and she was needing some additional assistance. So what he did was decide to move across country and begin to help assist her. And what he found was, you know, a lot of adults aren't necessarily caring for their parents when they get older, and definitely the male population. So he started learning a little bit about what it meant to, you know, take care of somebody who obviously took care of him growing up. He found it to be rewarding, but also, you know, a true challenge as well. And what he found was, you know, this is an interesting thing that a lot of people should be more willing to do. You know, adult life is busy, but that doesn't mean that when something comes up and a parent needs, you know, that caregiving, that we don't step up. So he's going to talk about that. He's going to talk about the book that he wrote about his experience. It's called A Cup of Tea on the Commode. So as you can probably guess, it does have some humor to it, because he's going to talk about kind of the humorous nature of, you know, dealing with his mother as she aged and dealt with various problems, including, you know, memory issues and a lot of other things. I think that you're really going to enjoy this one. You know, it is a serious topic when it comes to caregiving for a parent, but it's also a really kind of fun topic when it comes to kind of the amazing things that he learned from this experience. I think that, you know, he shares some really cool stories and some that are pretty funny. So I think you're going to really, really enjoy this one. I urge you to check out his book. All of that information will be at the end of this podcast. Follow this podcast as well, if you haven't already, on Instagram and on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast. Go leave a 5-star rating on Apple and on Spotify. That helps a lot. Written review on Apple helps even more. But let's just get right to the interview. Here is Mark Steven Porro. Mr. Porro, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting. Just introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Mark Steven Porro, and I am currently retired and living in the south of France, and I'm officially a published author now. So retirement didn't last so long. So I grew up in northern New Jersey. It's about 20 minutes outside of New York City, or 20 hours, depending on traffic. And it was a great little suburb. I have 5 siblings, 2 older brothers, 2 older sisters, and 1 younger sister. And my parents were both worked full time. My mother was a proofreader for the largest newspaper in New Jersey at the time, the Bergen Record. And my dad was a chemist for Sandoz Pharmaceuticals. So it was a really cool upbringing. The village is great. It's the village of Ridgewood. And so from 8th grade on, I wanted to be an ophthalmologist. And I never thought about why until later on in life. So I visited only 2 colleges, Harvard and the Ohio State University. And I went to the Ohio State University. Apparently, you know, somebody was a little pickier about test scores and things like that. So I had a good time in high school, but I didn't knuckle down and study as hard as I could have. But I tested well, I guess, in the college entrance things for Ohio State, and got placed in really high categories for math and science. So I was in like advanced physics and advanced calculus. And I'm like, wait, freshman year was supposed to be a little more fun. And I said, well, this is crazy. I don't really want to be doing this for 12 years. It was about a 12-year program for ophthalmology. And I started looking in the course book and I came across industrial design, which I never heard about before, but it was a perfect marriage of my loves, which was math and science and art. And I was very fortunate because they had one of the best design schools in the country at that time. So I graduated there and I was very lucky. I landed a nice design job with a really good firm in Columbus, Ohio, and then got recruited by one of the best design firms in the country. And did that for a bit, but then the acting bug bit me. And we were all performers as kids. My mother was a big champion of the arts. And so we used to go to New York City and go to theater and Radio City Music Hall for watching the Rockettes and any new Disney movies and stuff that came out. But also was very involved with the ballet. So we all got involved with the ballet as kids. And I retired from ballet around 11 years old. And then apparently the performance bug never left me, because in 1984, I decided to give up this lovely design career and move out to Hollywood to give that one a shot. So.
Yeah. That's a good little summation for sure. And I guess I want to ask you, you said that you're in the south of France. I don't, you know, most people aren't going to see your background, but I don't, if I was kind of picturing what your house would look like in the south of France, pretty sure that's it with the stone and everything. You've got kind of that stereotypical looking house. So I like it. Is that your living room?
Yeah, this is a living room and kitchen. And this is like the main room. So it's a living room and kitchen. And I also call my office. So this is where I do my writing and my my interviews and things like that. So I visited this village in 2015 for 5 days and fell in love with the village and the people. They're just so lovely. And the history here, this is this house was built, they say, in 1540. And I walked into this place and said, this is going to be my home. And a couple of years later, I moved here. We have French relatives on my mother's side. And I think the ancestors played a role in this, because I've been to Italy. My grandfather came from Italy. And so we're second generation Italian. The French, I'm not sure, it might be third or fourth generation on the French side. And when I first came to France, I had an old girlfriend or ex-girlfriend, I should say, who always wanted to retire in France. So that she put the bug in my ear. And the first time I came here, I was very comfortable in France overall, even more so than in Italy. And so I started thinking about it. And then we came to this village a couple of years later, and that was it for me. Yeah, I guess it's kind of a dream. It's also located in the largest wine growing region in the world. So if you're into wine, this is the place to be. It's actually probably cheaper than bottled water here. And the wine is excellent. So.
Yeah. Well, I think it's kind of funny. You said that she always wanted to do it. She's an ex-girlfriend and you're the one that actually is doing it now, huh?
I did it. Yeah, she had her opportunity. I don't know if she got nervous or something. Anyway, she bailed.
Well, she had the chance then.
Yeah, she had the chance.
Well, you're not roughing it by any means. That's a cool place for sure. So I want to ask you now. You already kind of touched on the the acting part of things, but as the I wrote the question was, you kind of went from Eye Doctor Dreams to Hill Street Blues acting. So talk a little bit about moving out to LA. You know, pursuing that dream. And I think part of that dream was to get in on Hill Street Blues, right?
Yeah. I had a connection actually through the design firm with an agent out in Hollywood. So I went out to Hollywood. I had a friend that I grew up with also that lived at the beach. So I went out there for vacation and I visited design firms. I landed a design job, so I wasn't going to be a struggling actor. So I had a nice design job waiting for me. I met with the agent and she was great. She said, you've got to start studying right away, because I had no acting training whatsoever. I did some commercials and did some modeling stuff in Ohio, but none of this real stuff. And so I hooked up with a teacher. And so when I moved back, I went back to Ohio to tie up loose ends and moved out there and started studying from day one. And one of my goals was I wanted to be a good actor. I didn't want to be a hack going in there and whatever. So I started studying and took it very seriously. And my goal was to get on a high quality show like Hill Street Blues. And so that was in my head. And in less than 2 years, I got on Hill Street Blues. Actually, my design experience helped me because I got a call. The gatekeepers in Hollywood are casting directors. So you have to get to know them and prove to them that you're a good actor to have an opportunity to meet the producers, directors, and things like that, especially in television. And one day I was really good from my background also in design was marketing. So as soon as I got out there and I felt I was good enough to start auditioning, I started sending out letters and flyers and your headshot and all that kind of stuff. And so this one casting director was a very big time one at that. In 1980, I guess probably 85 or so, called me. She goes, "I got good news and bad news. The good news is I'm interested in your design because I know good design and I really like your letterhead. The bad news is this is not an acting job, but would you like to design the national logo for the Casting Society of America?" That was not quite a union, but they were trying to unionize all the casting people. And they wanted to have a national identity. And that was my specialty in design, corporate identity. And so I jumped at that opportunity. I met all the movers and shakers in Hollywood. And I got cast in that one person who first contacted me, all three of her shows within the next couple of years. And then one of the people also was the lady who was casting Hill Street Blues. So we got to know each other as people. And then she had me come in an audition and said, "Okay, you're good enough to be on the show when I find the right part." So she found a part as an assistant district attorney. And it might have been the last season, second to last or last season. And that was great. It was just a lovely experience. And having that on your resume was really good because most people would then perk up and go, "Oh, if he's good enough for Hill Street Blues, he should be good enough to at least audition, you know, for our show." So that was a big deal, a very small part, but a big deal. And I met some really good people. Can I tell you a fun Hollywood story there?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, so we're shooting a courtroom scene, and in Hollywood normally you have an eight hour day, and if you go beyond that, it goes into overtime, and then something else, and then golden time, and then double golden time, which you're making really good money. I was like probably a scale actor at that point because it was really my first gig. But you go into double golden time, you're making some really good money. But it was a long day. And in the courtroom, there's what they call extras. And they're sitting in the courtroom the whole time. And this one gentleman had to be in his 80s. And we're there 11 or so hours, and he's having the best time of his life. And during one of our breaks, I sat with him because I was really curious. And I was hinting at, you know, "Don't you have something better to do with the time you have left?" And he said, "No, I love being around you young people. You give me energy and I love the creative people. And my daughter happens to own this studio." And I said, "Who's your daughter?" It was Mary Tyler Moore. This was MTM Studios. So at that point, you know, I was so new. I didn't know that was Mary Tyler Moore Studios. It was his daughter's studio. And he just loved hanging out where his daughter, you know, owned the place and worked. And it was just fabulous. So that was a really fun introduction. And a lot of those really good shows were filmed on that lot at the time. It may be called a different name now. I'm sure it was sold. But that was lovely. And then many years later, my dad and I appeared on Seinfeld on that same studio lot.
That's really, really awesome. Yeah. I don't feel like he was doing it to, you know, to make ends meet. It really was just for that connection. So
he certainly didn't need the money. It was very cool. And I was very lucky. I think if you go into anything with a good attitude, you'll have a really positive experience in most things. And so I was new. I was really good at design because I had really good experience and I was very lucky there. And acting, I was brand new. So it was like, hey, I'm open to everything with an open heart and open mind. And I had some really nice experiences early on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, we're talking about Hill Street Blues and now we're fast forwarding probably about 20 years because I've got to ask you a story about, you know, your time in Castaway, because I interviewed another person with a connection to Tom Hanks, very different than acting with him. But talk about being, you know, having a small role in Castaway too.
Well, in Hollywood, there's like a pecking order. So if you get a certain amount of credits and experience, you move up to, let's say, a better agent, which doesn't specialize in small parts and things like that. So I got to a point where I was working enough. And so I said, no more small parts. Let's go for the bigger things. And the competition gets a lot tougher. And also with the agencies, if you don't have a good agent, it's tough to even get seen for those parts because they get all the slots for their clients and stuff. So one day I got a call from my agent, said, would you be interested in, it's a small part, but it's in Castaway. So Robert Zemeckis is directing it, Spielberg is producing it, and Tom Hanks is starring in it. And I said, yeah. At that point, I was pretty busy. I had a snack. I started a lot of companies also. So I was pretty ambitious in Hollywood. So not only pursuing the acting, but I pursued a number of businesses. And most of those ended up being nonprofit, though none were intended to be. But I had a snack food company that was doing quite well and taking a lot of my time. But I said, you know, let me go check this out. And the pilot who was cast, he was the navigator. So there were four guys in the cockpit. But he had they were going overtime, and he had a commitment on a TV show he was doing up in Canada. So he had to leave. So they had to hire somebody who kind of looked like him. At that point, my hair was not gray or salt and pepper, but this gentleman was. So they said, we have to see if you look kind of like the guy. And then once I got past that point, the producer called me outside, and it was a speaking role and stuff. So you're going to make pretty good money, not Tom Hanks kind of money, but pretty good money. So the producer calls me outside and says, okay, so just so you know, you're going to be in the crash sequence. And in the crash sequence, you're going to be on something they call a gimbal. So he says, you're going to be like, for 3 days, you're going to be on a roller coaster. Can you handle that? And I jokingly said, I dated a French girl for 7 months. I can handle anything. And that was a true story. And I got him laughing. And I knew I had the part. So I got the part. And then he had grayed my hair and cut it to look like the other gentleman's. And it was fabulous. So I worked 3 days on that. And you can't recognize me in the most of the crash sequence actually is me, not the other pilot, but he was established. So he turned to Tom Hanks at one point and says his line. So he's recognized as the navigator. So his face was on screen. So the rest of the movie, even though the rest of the movie, or at least the crash sequence, was me, and I did all the dialogue, I couldn't be seen just by a profile. And every time I tried to turn, because Tom Hanks was sitting behind me, every time I tried to turn, they cut. And they said, Mark, you can't turn to the camera. And I said, I'm in a movie with Tom Hanks, directed by you, Mr. Zemeckis. Come on. And they said, no, you can't do it. But it was great. So it, actually in the trailer, if you stop it, you can recognize that it is me. But in the movie, it's real hard because so many other things are going on. But everything you've heard about Tom Hanks is true. He's just a sweetheart. I've dealt with a lot of egos in Hollywood. And Tom stayed on the set with us. A lot of guys just go right to their trailer and do their thing. He hung out with us. He called me the fifth Beatle because I was the fifth pilot. And it was lovely. And then Spielberg showed up for two of the days we were there. And it's just great hanging out with these people. So after I did that, I called my agent, said any small part in a big movie, anything, because you get spoiled. I mean, the food was great. The catering was great. All these people were fabulous, and you learned a lot of tips and tricks. The Zemeckis and his editor would be editing as they shot. Usually you shoot all the film and then you deal with the editing later. They were editing as they moved on, because we would see the sequences that we just shot, and with the new technology, it was amazing. So they would say, okay, we got it. Or, oh, no, we need to redo this thing because it didn't quite fit the way we planned. And it was a very efficient way to get it done. It was just fabulous. So that was excellent experience. I made really nice money, and I still get residuals. In fact, I just got a letter yesterday from foreign residuals from Germany, Spain, and Switzerland. So I'm still making some nice money from Castaway mainly. Actually, I still get some checks from Hill Street Blues as well. And that was done in 1986. Castaway was 1999. So that stuff is lovely. And the union, my gosh, whoever does the bean counting and stuff, there's just fabulous, because they really look out for you. So go Screen Actors Guild. It was just super.
No, that's awesome. And I wonder, given that, you know, it's two people playing the same part, what's that? What's the credits look like? Are you the navigator stand-in or what?
I forgot what they called me. I think originally I wasn't going to even be credited. And then I fought for that, because the hint I got from that is when they had the screening. So usually they have a cast and crew screening at the studio before it goes out to public. And I don't think I was on that list, and I found out about it. So I called my agent and said, hey, get me on that list. I was in the movie. And they did. And so they have... I think if they look it under IMDb, it's uncredited navigator. In the movie, it might be, I forget how it's credited. It's not like navigator number two. It might have been navigator replacement or something like that. I don't remember, but I get the credit because I still get the check. So as a speaking role, it's lovely. So,
yeah.
And
yeah,
I got Tom Hanks stories to talk about. I don't know if you know that there's the Kevin Bacon game in Hollywood. Like, there was, you know,
like six degrees of separation or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kevin Bacon is the thing. So I'm a number one because Kevin Bacon did Apollo 13 with Hanks, and I did the Castaway with Hanks. So I'm a number one in that game, which is the best.
Yeah, well, I know you, so maybe you've given me some degrees of separation. But I've got another one with Tom Hanks, and that is in a totally different world, and we won't dwell on it. But I interviewed the attorney for what was it? It was for some of the people who were on Captain Phillips' ship. You know, the movie that Tom Hanks was in. So. Yeah. Totally different world, and obviously that we won't even talk about that. But the attorney said, you know, obviously having Tom Hanks part of that completely changed the narrative didn't help. But he couldn't say anything bad about Tom Hanks because that he was a great guy. So
yeah.
So let's move from Tom Hanks to toilets, and we've got to talk about your book, and that is
Commodes sound much better.
Well, a cup of tea on the commode. Tell us what that's about, and then we're going to break it down.
Okay. So I'm still in Hollywood. I'm in my mid 50s, and my acting career was kind of like petering out, because I was aging out of that. Unless you have a certain amount of status, you can age out of things. It is a young business. So that was slowing down. I had a snack food business that was still almost a 24/7 business. And I had no children. I never had been married, and I had no particular relationship going at the time. And I get a call from my brother back in New Jersey. My mother was living in the house we all grew up in. And he said she just shut down. She was kind of in a semi-comatose state. And he put her to bed and called the doctor. And the doctor said, she's going. So call hospice and stop all meds, medication and food, and let her go. And it was like, wow. I mean, the hospice thing was enough, because 14 years earlier, we called hospice for my dad, and he died 2 days later. So everybody flew home. And she was, you know, in a non-responsive state. She did respond a little bit to touch, but she's in her bed. And she rarely opened her eyes and didn't speak. And so my younger sister and I hung out with hospice because we didn't know how long mom was. We were kind of on death watch. So we didn't know how long she was going to be with us, but we wanted to take care of her as much as we could. And so we learned all the tips and tricks from hospice, which was, you know, take care of any medical needs. She had some bed sores at the time, had to change the bed with a helpless patient in the bed, do the sponge bathing and changing the, at that point she was wearing diapers and stuff, and taking care of all that. And it was really nice for us. And I think that she kind of sensed that we were there. And at that point, she was living in her house. We had some people living upstairs who were supposed to kind of oversee household duties and keep her company. And we didn't know how bad it was, but they did not get along so well. And they left my mother alone quite a bit. And I think she was just depressed and said, if this is going to be my life, I'm done. And she just turned 89 when this thing happened. And while we were there, she slowly started snapping out of it. And I think it was, I have a chapter in the book called A Cry or Silent Scream or Silent Cry, Silent Scream for Help. And I think it was a cry for help. So her kids all came back. And once she snapped out of it, most of them left. And I hung out for a few more months and started looking at the surroundings and saying, well, you know, this house is no longer filled with the love that we had in it as we grew up. It needed repair in a lot of places. And these people were not helpful. And there was a lot of tension with my mother and stuff like that. So I knew something had to be done, and I didn't do it right away. But we hung out. We knew hospice was going to be there for at least 6 months. And so I went back to L.A. and got back to my business and stuff like that and kept in touch with my mother. And then later, a few months later, my nephew was getting married in New Jersey. So I flew back and resumed duties again. So I took care of my mom for those 2 weeks and realized that I needed to step up and do something. So I had two brothers that lived close by, but they both had their jobs and stuff like that. And I was, whether it's serendipity or whatever, but I asked my mom if she wanted me to come back to make sure she was well taken care of. And she said, yes. And so I made the decision. And then the world seemed to all come together and make it work out. So the logistics were a little cumbersome to make it work because I still lived in LA and my business wasn't primarily in LA. But I moved back into my childhood home and took over the duty. So I moved back that December, and then we had some part-time people come in. And then we looked for someone who, because I wasn't going to step in 24/7 right away. I still needed to make some money. So I was redesigning my brother's offices and stuff like that. So I had some income. And then we were not successful in finding somebody that we really liked to take care of my mom full time. So once I called it the parade of AIDS was unsuccessful, I decided I better step up. So I stepped up and took over the 24/7 care. And it was a huge deal for me, but the main goal was to make my mom happy and to make sure that she was well taken care of and well loved, and I cooked good food and all kinds of stuff. So it was a very important deal for me, but also the joy it seemed to bring her was really.
So why do you think, because that's not a story that, you know, happens a lot. It is that people try to find AIDS and if that doesn't work out, then, you know, people are put in nursing homes, unfortunately. Right. So why do you think that there's not, and this is a more of a U.S. problem, you know, that a lot of other countries do care for their elderly a little bit better than we do. So
Right. Why
do you think that caregiving is, I guess, something that is not, you know, not something that people do as much, and definitely, you know, when it comes to sons, it's not as prevalent.
Right. Yeah. I think it's still like a 60-40 split. It's getting better though, because I've heard I've gotten a lot of response and personal notes from people who have read the book. And I'd probably say half of them are men, and they love it, and it's great. And so one of the goals with the book is to help inspire sons to jump in and do this, because it was, I mean, it was lovely. It's very stressful. But again, I went in and, you know, once I asked my mom, so kind of a funny story. So I asked, you know, I said, "Mom, do you want me to come in and make sure you're healthy and safe?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Okay, I will do everything in my power to make sure that happens. But do you understand if I do this, I will be in charge. And that means you must now obey me." And her mood completely shifted. And then she puckered up for a kiss, because she was, I called her a kissing bandit. She loved the kisses. And I wasn't sure if that was a sign of surrender or one wishing me luck. And I gave her a kiss and hoped for the best. And it was good. I also told her, I said, "You know, if I do this, we're going to have fun." And that was the goal. My goal was to make her laugh at least once a day. She had a really good sense of humor, and my dad did as well. And fortunately, they passed that on to their kids, because we're all a bit goofy and stuff. So that was my goal. And I think if you go in, you know, with that goal, it helps you get through the really stressful times. Because I did one of these interviews with a guy that specialized in the stress for caregivers. And he said, I think it's over 30% of caregivers die before their patient does. That's how stressful it is. I didn't know it was that high. I knew it could have been. And it actually almost happened to me. My mother almost outlived me. And I'm not sure if it's totally stress related, but I had, during our stay, I had to go through three emergency surgeries. So that was quite interesting. So that was a curveball thrown to me, you know, from left field and stuff like that. But what was good about that is my goal was to get out and get healthy so I can get back to work and take care of my mom. And she never knew. Nobody told her how bad it was, let's say, for me, which I guess was good. But also it helped, I think, another lesson that I learned, not only about unconditional love, because not having children and things like that, I could easily, my MO before that was like, if I got bored, I moved on. You know, I started another company, or if the relationship wasn't great, I moved on and stuff like this. But in this particular case, there was no moving on until my mother decided to move on. So that was a good lesson. But another one was empathy. And you really have to put yourself in your patient's shoes, or your loved one's shoes, or in my mom's case, her non-slip safety socks, because she never walked or never wore shoes again after this incident. So that was very important. And when I was in the hospital, I had to deal with a lot of things that my mother dealt with. I needed assisting with walking. I had to wear diapers for a period of time. I was on heavy medication, so my mother suffered from a little bit of dementia, and I was hallucinating like crazy at some point. I had to drink some of the same protein drinks that she drank to help me heal faster and stuff like that. So it was a good lesson, hopefully something I wouldn't have to deal with until way in the future. But I really got to, I guess, empathize with my mother's condition even more so. So that was a very important lesson. And also, I think the main lesson from that is you really do have to take breaks. It is a very stressful thing. And they say that you really need to take, and up to that point, I did not. I said, I'm a guy, I can take this on, no big deal. And it creeps up. And so take breaks is the main thing. It's on the airlines, they say, you know, put your oxygen mask on before you handle your child. And there's a reason for that, because you have to be in good shape if you're going to take care of these people.
That's an eye-opening thing to me when you say the 30%, because I'll tell you, you're currently right now, my mother is caregiving for my grandmother who has dementia, and she's been doing it for like 2 years now. And it's been a challenge, and you talk about taking breaks, and that's kind of at this exact moment that we're at right now. My grandmother is in rehab because she had fallen, and now she needs to be able to be mobile again. So she's been in rehab for 3 weeks. And this is the point now that it's almost been 3 weeks. that my mom, you know, hasn't been caregiving. She's like just realizing how much stress she's had for these past, you know, year and a half while she has this break. So, I mean, that's eye opening to me because I certainly don't want, you know, her health to completely suffer because of, you know, this type of thing. So that's tough for sure. I think that's, yeah, that's rough. And I mean, it gives me so much more respect for people who are able to do it because, yeah, I mean, you know, and your family's probably maybe different just because, you know, I don't know, but there's a, I've seen a lot of times, you know, when I've read about caregiving and stuff, that almost some of the family, other family sometimes resents it because they're like, oh, well, you don't even have to work. You're just sitting at home and hanging out with mom. And that's not the case at all. I mean, it's a 24/7 job doing some things that I guarantee you don't want to be doing. So,
right. It's mentally, physically, and emotionally very stressful. Even when you're laying in bed, you're wondering how they're doing or, you know, if they're going to be breathing when I wake up in the morning. At one point, I put a baby monitor, a video monitor in her room. And my mom, she worked the graveyard shift for the newspaper. So she was a night owl. And I was kind of a night owl also. And I would stay up and I would watch my phone and watching her in bed. And she'd be awake most of the time, fidgeting, having conversations with somebody out there. And it was fascinating. It was better than anything on TV, but it was even more stressful because I should have just stayed in the room because I could have relaxed more as opposed to watching this thing on TV, you know, in a bedroom upstairs.
Yeah. And you already talked about humor and I want to ask about that again here in a minute, but I'm going to say this. And I think that, you know, based on humor is important. It sounds a little bit mean, but I do think, you had a little bit of an easier time, huge air quotes, given that you said that she was bedbound, because that's the big problem my mom has. My grandma's still mobile and she's worried about, I mean, she'll just take off and almost fall down the stairs or almost light the house on fire. So at least she wasn't moving, right?
Yeah. But she wanted to. Occasionally she said, why don't you put this bed rail down? And I said, Mom, because you can't walk and it's for your safety. She goes, well, if you put the rail down, maybe I could walk. And it's like, no. And another time she said, why is it I always call you? Why don't you ever call me? And I said, Mom, you call me, I come running. I call you, what are you going to do? I don't know. You know, we had these lovely, funny conversation. Another time it was like, I would get to sleep late at night. And get up when she got up. Luckily, she got up, you know, maybe around 10 a.m. She slept a lot. It's like a baby. They sleep many, many hours. And but one day I get up at 6 o'clock, I'm hearing her calling for me. And, of course, you fly out of bed. You fly down the stairs. You get in and she goes, oh, you are here. Of course I'm here. Where else am I going to be? I just wanted to check. And I said, can you please check a couple hours later next time? But that, again, you have to laugh at it because it was fun. And then you see her smiling and she was pretty charming when she wanted to be. And you just have to roll with the punches. And again, a lot of that is the attitude. You say, listen, I'm taking this on. My motto is find the joy in it. And so if you say, okay, if I don't find the humor, somehow I got to find the joy in it. And then when you get to a point where, maybe she smiles unexpectedly or one of the main things I did when I first took over is, you know, she was 89. The night dresses or day dresses she wore were like tattered and kind of ugly. And she, you know, was dressed like an old lady. And I said, no, this is not going to work. So I bought my mom a new wardrobe and boy, that perks her up. You know, there were some really good things. And I knew a little bit about color for her complexion and things like that. And my mother, since she worked full time and had six kids, she used to treat herself to the a trip to the beauty salon once a week. And she had beautiful nails. She was a nail model in the late 20s or late teens, early 20s. So she had these gorgeous, long, natural nails. And so I created a thing called Day of Beauty. So once a week, I normally gave her two sponge baths a day anyway. But on Day of Beauty, while she sat on the commode, I soaked her feet in Epsom salts. I shampooed her hair and got her all ready and then had her choose what wardrobe she wanted to wear. and then blow dried her hair and put it in a ponytail, or sometime for bonus points, I said I would braid it. I learned a lot growing up with three sisters with long hair. So there were some benefits to that other than learning how to put the toilet seat down. And so once she was done, I would do her nails and then gave her some bright red lipstick to match her bright red nails. And I didn't think that much of it other than a son trying to make her mother feel a little better. I put her in a wheelchair and I'm wheeling her into the kitchen. As we're going into the kitchen, we pass a large round mirror in the dining room. And I parked her in front of that mirror. Now, I don't know the last time she even looked in the mirror, but I don't know the last time she looked in the mirror and liked what she saw. But whatever she saw that day was gorgeous. And she just beamed. And I leaned into her cheek to cheek and said, "Who is that pretty girl?" And it was just I thought at the time was just a small gesture, no big deal. But boy, the effect on this woman was absolutely incredible. And whatever she was feeling, it was contagious because everybody around her sensed it. So the wardrobe and the day of beauty just was very, very cool. And as I'm talking to more and more people about just that part, the day of beauty part, they're saying more and more care facilities, whether nursing homes or assisted living, are having beauty people come in. And it's amazing. Even with my dad, years earlier, he was always well-groomed. And a couple of days before he passed, my sister and I shaved him. We gave him a nice shave and he felt and combed his hair, and it was important for him as well. So I think for men and women, they don't lose that desire to be handsome and pretty at 90, you know, mm-hmm. and those little things they don't leave us. We assume they do. They're old, they're over this stuff. No, they're not over that. It's very important.
No, I love that. So how long were you a full-time caregiver and what years are we talking about? Was this a while back or when was this?
Yeah, my mom actually passed 10 years ago. So this all started in 2011. And I assumed full-time duty. I mean, I came in the end of 2011 to move back. And then in 2012, when our search for an aide didn't work, so I started taking over. So our adventure, I say, lasted 3.5 years. And I wasn't doing the 24/7 at full time, but a good part of it. And then I was in the house and supervising when I couldn't do it, especially after my surgeries. I couldn't do the heavy lifting because at that point, before that, I had to carry mom everywhere, whether it was in the wheelchair or so, but I would carry her upstairs and down to the basement and things like that. And we took road trips. So we did a lot of really cool things that I could no longer carry her after that. So that was a little sad, but I was still there and doing a lot of the cooking. And
Yeah. And the reason I wanted to know kind of the time frame is because I think the answer may change, you know, as time went on. So it's been, you know, 10 years since you've had this experience. Well, looking back, what do you cherish most about that time?
Well, I'd have to say all of it. Making my mom smile was really important. And I was with her when she took her last breath. It was interesting. So in the book, I really chronicled this, the whole 5-day thing. So she seemed to be, again, it was another 3.5 years later, but again, ready to check out. And at this time, her body and her mind were in sync. Before her mind was wanting to check out, but she wasn't ready to go. And this time it was. And so for the last 5 days, I took over full time and said, okay, I'm going to be with her and I'm going to make sure she's not alone when she takes her last breath. And it was she seemed to be in a hurry to leave, but no hurry to die. And it was 5 days. It was 5 days of me being up almost all that time. That itself was a lovely experience because she knew she did open her eyes. I think the last day and looked at me and I said, whenever she opens her eyes, I want to make sure she sees a smiling face, not someone sobbing or someone stressed. And she looked at me and she mouthed, "I love you." That was very important for her to know that I was there. When she took her last bit, my little sister was there also. I took a lot of notes. I didn't know what I was going to do with this, but I knew that I was going to be privy to a lot of moments and conversations that the other family members were not going to be. So I wanted to record all this stuff. And I took a lot of photographs and videos and kept notes all the time. And, you know, a lot of that is in the book. And I hope my siblings all read the book and they've said some really nice things about it. And I'm sure they, I guess, discovered some things that may not have, because my mom and I, and even with my dad, we had a very interesting relationship. I was a very curious kid and I got them to open up. They were both, you know, depression kids. So you kept your emotions close to the vest. You did not share. I don't recall them ever talking about pain or being, you know, letting their emotions out all that much. Maybe in the marriage, but towards the kids and stuff like that, we didn't know what pain they may have been going through and stuff like that. But I got them both to open up because I asked questions. And so a lot of those little stories I put in the book, and more of those will go into the next book is going to focus more on my dad. And they're lovely. And it's not all you know, rosy, but I wanted to tell a truthful, honest story. So, you know, there's enough honest things about me that I'm not super proud of, but I put them in the book because I thought it was important to be honest. So I guess that's the main thing. Someone also asked me, how would your mom feel about this book? And it's kind of interesting because, again, they never talked about these things. But I think if they knew the benefit of it, because there's been some lovely, I mean, the critics have been great. It's won 8 awards so far, and the sales are nice. But the personal notes I'm getting from people are just lovely. And I think if they knew that would change everything, because for me, I don't know how I was expecting the response to be. You put your heart and soul into something, you don't know. But, you know, when you start getting some of these notes and stuff, it's like, wow, this is very cool.
Yeah. What was the writing process like? Did you find it, you know, kind of tough to relive those things and go through it again? Did you find it kind of therapeutic or cathartic to kind of get it all out? Or what was that? What was that, that journey?
Well, so my mom passed in August of 2014. I had all the notes. And whenever I would think about a certain thing, I would jot down a note, but I couldn't write it. I'm a really emotional guy, and especially when it comes to family. So I'm a sap. So it was a couple of years later that I actually, when I moved to France, I said, I think I'm okay to do this. And I wasn't sure if it was going to be a book, because I've written screenplays and I've done short films and things like that. But while I was going through this, I had some friends, you know, being a baby boomer, we're all going to deal with this or have dealt with it or are currently dealing with this. I had some friends going through it, and I shared some of the things I was going through, and they seemed to get some benefit from it. So that's when I decided I think a book is going to be the best way to get this message out there. And it's also entertaining. There's a lot of funny stuff in there. I say it's not a how-to book. It's a what I did book, which was a very unique approach. Also, just being from a son, it's a unique approach. And once I decided on the book, it was going to be memoir, was going to be the best genre. So I started studying the craft. And it was great. So I got to a point where I was felt okay to do it. But boy, still writing. It was a couple of years of writing. And then working out the structure. But I was here on my own, and good thing, because I would burst out crying. Even some parts that weren't even that sad. It was just, it creeps up on you, just go. So I'm sitting there going, oh, I'm so glad I'm alone, because this is just terrible. And then when I finished the book, I had actually my memoir teacher was also an editor. So I had her do the first edit of the book. And she gave me great notes. And so then I refined it, and I actually got a publisher, which is very rare, especially a first-time writer who's in it at that point in his 60s. So that was great. So I found a publisher, and they liked the voice, they liked my writing, and they thought the book had wonderful potential because I think of the message and the entertainment value. So that was lovely. But I would say in the writing, the most difficult part after I got through the emotional part was the structure, because if you write it chronologically, you know, this is what happened day one, day two, it's kind of boring. So I kept the adventures of mom and I over those 3.5 years kind of intact. But in between, I put some flashbacks or some stories that happened at another time that help support why I made that choice or why I stepped up at this time or why my mother did these things. And that was very cathartic because once you kind of open a door to certain memories, all these other things start coming out. And you get to a point where you have to edit like crazy because, okay, this is not important. Part of that was important. So you had to needle it down to the fine moment or something that's going to get your point across. But boy, that was lovely. And then there was a lot of stuff that I thought it's more appropriate for my dad's book. So the last draft I did, I cut out, I think, over 4,000 words. And they were good words, but they didn't belong in this book. So they will go into the next book. And I'm sure there's going to be some overlap because there's a lot of my dad in this book as well. But I'd say the structure of working out those flashbacks with the present day was the most difficult part for me. And then once we got that down, once I got with the publisher, I worked with two different editors and they were great. The notes were great. And it was great to have a fresh set of eyes looking at this story and getting it or not getting it. Like, why is this here? And then I would try to explain it. But as soon as you have to try to explain it, it's like trying to explain a joke. You know you lost. So you've got to rewrite or reorganize. And so there was a lot of reorganization in this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm kind of setting you up to say everyone, and that's an acceptable answer. But who do you think is going to enjoy this book when they pick it up? Who's the book for?
Well, originally it was for baby boomers. So people in my age group, you know, born in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And there's a lot of retirees, expats, retirees in this village that I live in France. And so they have a group called Tuesday Club. And so I was asked to come and present. This is before the book was published. And so I read a few chapters and talked about this, the story. And one of the ladies stood up and said, when is this coming out? Because I want to give this to my children so they know how to take care of me. And I thought that was lovely. And that opened up a whole nother thing. So the demographics then expanded to go younger. I think really young people, you know, maybe not, they're not ready for that. But there are, again, a lot of funny stories in there. So I would say definitely the baby boomers. And I'm also surprised because there's some people who say, I've been through this. I don't want to revisit this, you know, whoever did it. But I've had other people who said, yes, I wanted to see how someone else approached this. And it brought back so many nice memories and things. So these personal notes have been fabulous. So yeah, I wouldn't say everybody. And mostly I would say, for me, it's been pretty good about 50-50, but I would think more women than men, because again, they assume this role more than the men. And that I think has been my experience. If I look at, let's say, the sales numbers, and when you do ads, you look at the analytics and stuff like that. And so the women still, I think, outpace the men as far as sales and things like that. So,
yeah. Then you've already kind of talked about how there's going to at least be one more book, and it's you know, highlighting your dad's story. So what does the future look like for you as a writer? Are you going to get your dad's story out and you're done? Are you going to start looking at, you know, the world of fiction, or what does writing look like for you?
I don't know about fiction, but I got a lot of stories. So with my dad's book, there's actually, originally it was going to be three different book ideas, and they all revolve around my dad. And I thought, you know what, I think I could put all these three into one book. And focus it just on the moments that I think are most important and not expand, because this snack food company that my brother and I started was in honor of my dad. My dad invented this thing called, it was like half pop popcorn. He called it Nutri-Nuts originally, and he invented this stuff in 1963. That's when things like McDonald's and all those things are really starting to pop up. And he had six kids. And I think part of his motivation was he feared impending dental bills. So he wanted to keep us away from not only junk food, but also candy. And so he came up with this popcorn thing where he half popped it. Now, he was a chemist. He was a very clever guy. And so instead of a big, fluffy, white popcorn, it was these gold, crunchy golden nuggets. And they were addicting. That we loved these as kids. But it stayed as a family secret. He approached some big companies over the next couple decades, and nothing worked out. And then he stopped making them in the 80s. It's a really messy process. And my mother was never happy with the condition of the kitchen afterwards. But and then my nieces and nephews started popping out in the 80s and 90s. And they would hear about this Nutri-Nut thing. And so I thought, what a shame. They never got to taste this stuff that their grandpa made. So I asked my dad for the recipe. And I tried to make it on my own growing up. I helped him a lot when I was a little kid, but I was never successful. And so I finally got the recipe from him. And I had to do some experimentation. And the first time I cooked it in L.A., I almost burned down my apartment. So I understood the danger of this stuff, but I didn't take that as a bad omen, at least. I had, at that point, I was studying at the Beverly Hills Playhouse. So I had like 80 people in my class. They were like my test kitchen. And they loved this stuff. And then I started giving it away as gifts in Hollywood when I'd go on auditions or when I got an acting job, I would take samples. And people went nuts over this stuff. And then I started doing research and out in the marketplace and going to food shows. And there was still nothing like it on the market. And this was 40 something years later. So I said, okay, well, I think we have something here. And I got my dad's permission to move forward with it. And unfortunately he passed the year before we got on the market. And we were in the stores in 1998, and it went nationwide, and we had a really good run. And it was the snack of the day on the Rachel Ray Show, and that got us national distribution. And I handled the West Coast, and my brother handled the East Coast. And whenever we tried to get national sales managers and stuff like that, it was really a game and not a fun game. And then you have the big guys that come after you. And if they can't buy you, they can cause trouble. So we used organic popcorn. And sometimes the organic farms were completely out of corn because somebody swooped in and bought it. So it can be, in fact, you're in Indiana. So, at one point we had there's so many different kinds of popcorn, but there was a certain kind that worked really well with our product. And there was a lab in Indianapolis that I dealt with at one point. And I said, told them what I needed and how we made this stuff. And they gave me samples. And so they were very helpful because they said, okay, this farm in Kansas grows this kind of corn. And this one in Texas grows this kind of corn. And it was very helpful. So that was, so thank you, Indiana. Anyway, so I spent probably 15 years in that business. We built a beautiful factory out in LA and had a good run. So that's one of the stories, and that could be a book in itself. And then I took my dad to the village where his father came from in Italy. It's a village, we didn't know that much about it, and because his father never went back. His grandfather, who was the first to come over, never went back. So it had been over 100 years since Aporo had been back to this little village. And I was working on a stage adaptation of a Fellini film. And I got into my Italian roots and really curious about my Italian ancestry and stuff like that. So I did some research and then planned this trip. And my dad was just turning 80. And I talked him into coming with me, and I shot a documentary of it. And that could be a whole nother book. But I thought, between the snack food and the trip to Italy, and then just my dad, I had spent the last 8 days with my dad when he was sick back in 1997. And so I think all three of those, and they really do. The ending of the book is great because all three of those things come together in that little mountaintop village in Italy. Once I got that moment and said, oh my gosh, all three of these work out perfectly, I thought that's a great ending for the book. And so again, structurally, how to figure all that out is going to be quite a challenge. But coming out with the memories and all that stuff, no problem. Those just flood out of me, and I just got to make them sound good or read well.
Well, you've got, I mean, I think you've got a whole second book that's going to be interesting to read. Well, we'll have to connect again at that point, because you've got a lot of stories there too, but you're an awesome storyteller for sure. I think that we've got a lot to chew on already. I think we could talk for another hour, but I want you to tell us how people are going to pick up this first book and how people are going to connect with you to make sure that they know when the next one's coming.
Okay. Well, if they Google A Cup of Tea on the Commode, we're everywhere. We're everywhere from Facebook to Instagram, Pinterest, TikTok. And my own website is acupoftheacommode.org. But the book is on Amazon is your best bet. It comes in ebook, large print, paperback, and also audiobook. I did the audiobook, and that was tough because, again, with the emotion. So I did that about 6 months after the book came out. The book came out on Mother's Day last year. And then I couldn't do the audiobook without, crying throughout the darn thing for a number of months. So all my acting skills came into play on that one. I did want to give you the story about so the title came out of my mom, again, could no longer walk after this. So we had to set a commode bedside. And sometimes Mother Nature took a little longer than it was comfortable for either one of us on the commode. So her favorite beverage was a cup of hot tea, skim milk, no sugar. And one morning, kind of as a joke, I said, "Would you like a cup of tea while you're sitting on the commode?" And she said, "Yes." And so I gave her a cup of tea, and it was a hit. So there was no rush for her to do her business. And she had a lovely cup of tea. So I said, my mom was also multitasking. And so that just came out of practicality, but also it's a really, I think, catchy title. Everybody seems to like. So A Cup of Tea in the Commode was a practical and also very, again, lucky title that just kind of came to me.
No, I like the title too. I was going to ask you about it, but I made the mistake of saying toilet instead of commode, and you like commode better, so I moved on from the toilet humor, literally. So
yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I really, really appreciate you and your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun, and I usually say that anytime I could share my mom's stories, keep her in the present, and so that's my gift. So I thank you for that.
Absolutely. So that's Mark Stephen Poro. Really enjoyed our conversation. I think what we should gain from this conversation is that caring for a loved one, caring for a parent, is not an easy thing. I don't think he, sugarcoated it by any means, but what it is a rewarding thing. I'm sure that it's something that, looking back on, he's going to remember for the rest of his life, that time that he had with his mother, and that very close bond that they shared during the time that his mother needed him the most, frankly. He's certainly has been rewarded at this point for those efforts, and he's living life in beautiful France, like we talked about. He looks like he almost lives in like a wine cellar cave, an amazing place. But I really, really enjoyed speaking with Mark Stephen Poro. I think that, he's a great guy. So much more we could have talked about, more about his career in acting, more about his father. I mean, his father had some really awesome things happening as well with his inventions. I urge you to check out his book. He's going to have more books coming out. So you'll want to follow along with him. So you'll want a cup of tea on the commode. You'll want to follow along with him. So you can make sure that you can catch all these future books coming out. All the links to connect with him will be in the show notes. Also in the show notes will be the links to this podcast, social media on Instagram and on Spotify, TikTok, Facebook, all those things. Most of it is Not Enough Podcast on Facebook, Not Enough with Jackson Huff, jacksonhuff.com. It really helps a lot if you leave that 5-star rating on Apple and on Spotify, leave a written review on Apple. It really, really helps the podcast. So I appreciate you being here. We'll see you next week.
Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.